plate a potential nugget.
Moving to a different theme, Alyssa, co-founders, right? Both co-founder selection and sort of working through the co-founder relationship. Maybe starting with the selection. You use the term unforced error somewhere in the context of what founders and leaders could do. But what are some of the common unforced errors you see founders make in the way they go around selecting the co-founders?
Well, it's actually the same as I was talking about with the board. They don't check into the background of the co-founder. They have a few conversations. They're excited about the same thing. And that's it. They get into business together. They don't think about making sure they're both going to have the same work ethic, which I've seen many times where the founders have different work ethics and then they get angry at each other, understandably so, because they didn't talk about it in advance. They don't talk about how they deal with conflict. They don't even, you know, take enough time to have conflict together and then get themselves out of it. You know, in my book, I talk about two founders, one of whom wanted to build kind of a lifestyle business and one of whom wanted to build a really big business. And they never discussed that. So they didn't discuss kind of the overall vision or future of what they wanted to build together. So all of those things together, you know, are just the lack of the unforced error there is we didn't get to know each other before we got into this relationship. And what I say in the book is when you have a co-founder, you have a marriage and you have to treat it like that. And you have to kind of get to know this person and walk through their makeup, to your point earlier, their baggage, the things they bring to the table, good and bad. Also, you've got to make sure you've got complementary strengths. And if you do that, you'll have a better chance of making sure this is the right co-founder. But co-founder conflict is the cause of actually quite a large number of startup failure. Like I think it's 65% of startup failure. Yeah.
And moving to co-founder relationship, I really like one of the things you say in the book. You say that, you know, one of the questions you ask is, how's the dynamic with the co-founder similar to the dynamic of the family you grew up in? I thought it was an interesting question. In a way, I guess it ties back to the earlier point about some of the old patterns playing out in a different canvas. Okay, but can you throw the light on this question and what the founders could reflect on here?
I think that we unconsciously put ourselves into environments that we kind of replicate from childhood. And when I say unconsciously, I really mean unconsciously, but somehow you draw people to you who are going to help you play out your family drama. And then in doing so, hopefully you can heal, you know, in a good way that actually helps everybody kind of heal from their background and their trauma. But what that means is that if you had, let's say, a father who was explosive and would just, you know, fly off the handle at any moment, you may, without realizing it, find a co-founder who is just like that. It's just like your father. Or if you have a sense of like your brother was always the star, always the sports hero, always like the big shot in the family, you might find a co-founder who's like always a star, always the big shot, kind of always looking for attention in the business. And then you're going to feel resentful like you did for your brother. And so it comes back to self-awareness. The more you're aware of what you're bringing to the table in terms of your drama and your trauma, your baggage, the more you'll be able to, first of all, try to not just replicate that drama. And also you'll be able to recognize it when it comes up in your other business relationships and then deal with it like a thing, not deal with it like you're still fighting with your father.
On co-founder selection, I really like what Nandan Nilekani said when I had him on the podcast a few years back. I asked him about his insights given his journey at Infosys, and here's what he said.
No, I think the choice of co-founders is one of the seminal choices of any startup for multiple reasons. First is that you must share common vision. You must share a common value system. You must share a common desire to postpone your gratification for another day. Because building companies, especially building companies to last, is not a sprint, it's a marathon.
Right.
So if your partners are short-term oriented, your partners want quick rewards. If your partners have ethical issues, it doesn't work.
The time frames need to...
Everybody should say, okay, we're willing to defer reward for a decade. Now, that's a big ask. So I think the big lesson in Infosys was that, and Murthy had done a great job in assembling the people, the fact that all of us were united in a common vision to create a global company. All of us were united that you're going to do a very ethically run company with clear standards of ethics and corporate governance, and that we are willing to defer gratification for decades if required. That was the binding glue, and the fact that we put the vision above any of us. So I think getting the right founders is very important from a vision, values, time frame of gratification point of view. But there's a second dimension, which is that common founders are required for complementary skills, because everybody is not good at everything. So somebody is good at technology, somebody is good at finance, somebody is good at marketing, somebody is good at strategy, whatever. And therefore, it's one is to make sure they have the same values and so on. But second, they also should have complementary skills. And the best companies have founders who have complementary skills. In our case, we all together, we cover all the bases in some sense. So I think both these things are very important.
While the point around complementarity of skill sets and values fit is often well understood, the point around alignment of duration for which you're building the business is often an overlooked point. And as other people come along, like spouses and children and families, those factors start pulling the co-founders in different directions. The other thing Alyssa speaks about is conflict resolution. On this podcast, we had the opportunity to speak with Jennifer Goldman-Wetzler, an expert on conflicts and resolution. And she speaks about four default archetypes of conflict resolution and how we all end up gravitating towards one or the other. She speaks about how we can be mindful about our styles and adapt depending on the situation.
So there are four conflict habits. One of them is one that I mentioned before, which is that some of us, in our quest to win a conflict, we might feel competitive, and this can be a healthy thing. But when we take it to an extreme, when we habitually want to win a conflict, we can become, it can get to the point where we end up, or other people end up experiencing us as blaming them. And so we will kind of go on the attack and blame other people. In contrast, others of us habitually blame ourselves. We may blame and shame ourselves. So again, we may do this with good intentions. So our intention may be to learn from a situation and do better next time. But when we habitually do this, sometimes we end up stewing in our own negative self-talk, which doesn't free us from any kind of conflict whatsoever. It just keeps us stuck in that conflict situation. The third conflict habit is shutdown. And that is where we may, again, well-intentionally avoid a conflict situation, which can be a helpful way to deal with conflict when, for example, you don't, the issue is not that important to you, or the person you're dealing with is not that important to you. And so avoidance can be useful. But again, when that's the only way that we know how to deal with conflict, and we're avoiding issues that are important, or we're avoiding people who whose relationships are important to us, then it becomes an unhealthy way to deal with conflict. And what typically happens is that the conflict, you know, will avoid. The conflict is kind of bubbling slowly, simmering, simmering, and then boom, you know, it explodes at a point when we least expect it. And then we have to go deal with that. And we're not prepared. And then finally, one of the other ones that we talked about before is relentlessly collaborate. And that is where we have been taught often, like we were saying before, from a young age, that the way to deal with conflict is to offer other people options, think about what their interests might be, come up with creative solutions, work with them to come up with those creative solutions. And again, that's a really excellent toolbox and skill set to have. And for so many millennia, people didn't have that way of thinking about dealing with conflict. And we got into all sorts of messes because we didn't have that skill set. But even that, people can get so tied and committed to using this collaborative skill set that we end up pouring energy, time, resources, money into trying to work things out with someone or a group of people who just aren't interested in collaborating or cooperating with us. And so there's all that, you know, wasted time, money, energy, resources down the drain. And so there's got to be a better way. So actually, there's a free quiz online that people can take if they're interested to find out which one of these four conflict habits is your default. And if you go to optimaloutcomesbook.com/assessment, you'll find the quiz and you can take it. It's fun and helps people figure it out quickly.
Do tune into the conversation with Jennifer Goldman-Wetzler if you'd like to know more about your approach to conflict management. You can find her at the guest section at playtopotential.com. Like they say in marriage, there's nothing called they lived happily ever after. They worked on it to stay happy ever after is more like it. Thank you for listening.